Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, where we talk about the professional feuds, sex scandals, messy public breakups, and controversial legacies of history's literary legends, brought to you by the American Writers Museum.
Hi, I'm Zakiya Zaliva Harris. My debut novel, The Other Black Girl, comes out June 1st from Atria Books in the U.S. and Bloomsbury Books in the U.K.
And I'm Jennifer Cation Armstrong. I've written 7 books about pop culture history, including the New York Times bestseller, Seinfeldia, and When Women Invented Television. Ketchum, Idaho, July 2nd, 1961. Ernest Hemingway was found dead of a shotgun wound in the head at his home here today. His wife, Mary, said that he had killed himself accidentally while cleaning the weapon. Mr. Hemingway, whose writings won him a Nobel Prize and a Pulitzer Prize, would have been 62 years old, July 21st. Frank Hewitt, the Blaine County Sheriff, said after a preliminary investigation that the death looks like an accident. He said, there is no evidence of foul play. The body of the bearded, barrel-chested writer, clad in a robe and pajamas, was found by his wife in the foyer of their modern concrete house. A double-barreled 12-gauge shotgun lay beside him with one chamber discharged. Mrs. Hemingway, the author's fourth wife, whom he married in 1946, issued this statement. Mr. Hemingway accidentally killed himself while cleaning his gun this morning at 7:30 a.m. No time has been set for the funeral services, which will be private. Mrs. Hemingway was placed under sedation. Coroner Ray McGoldrick said tonight that he would decide tomorrow, after speaking to Mrs. Hemingway, whether to hold an inquest. Mr. Hemingway was an ardent hunter and an expert on firearms. His father, Dr. Clarence E. Hemingway, was also devoted to hunting. He shot himself to death at his home in Oak Park, Illinois, in 1928, at the age of 57, despondent over a diabetic condition. The death weapon was a Civil War pistol that had been owned by the physician's father. The theme of a father's suicide note cropped up frequently in Mr. Hemingway's short stories and at least one novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls. Mr. Hemingway was given his first shotgun at the age of 10. President Kennedy mourned tonight the death of Ernest Hemingway, whom he called one of America's greatest authors and one of the great citizens of the world.
Hollywood, California, December 22nd, 1940. F. Scott Fitzgerald, novelist, short story writer, and scenarist, died at his Hollywood home yesterday. His age was 44. He suffered a heart attack 3 weeks ago. Mr. Fitzgerald in his life and writings epitomized all the sad young men of the post-war generation. With the skill of a reporter and ability of an artist, he captured the essence of a period when flappers and gin and the beautiful and the damned were the symbols of the carefree madness of an age. Roughly, his own career began and ended with the 1920s. This Side of Paradise, his first book, was published in the first year of that decade of skyscrapers and short skirts. Only 6 others came between it and his last, which, not without irony, he called Taps at Reveille. That was published in 1935. Since then, a few short stories, the script of a moving picture or two, were all that came from his typewriter. The promise of his brilliant career was never fulfilled. The best of his books, the critics said, was The Great Gatsby. When it was published in 1925, this ironic tale of life on Long Island at a time when gin was the national drink and sex the national obsession, according to the exponents of Mr. Fitzgerald's School of Writers, it received critical acclaim. In it, Mr. Fitzgerald was at his best, which was, according to John Chamberlain, his ability to catch the flavor of a night, a snatch of old song in a phrase. In this episode, we'll be discussing 2 larger-than-life writers whose books many of us first read either in high school or in college, Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald. The two are often put in conversation with one another, and for good reason. Hemingway was in many ways a protege of Fitzgerald, Both belong to The Lost Generation, a label for those who came of age during World War I that also includes T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, and Gertrude Stein, who coined the term herself. And last but definitely not least, both Hemingway and Fitzgerald wrote works that many of us were required to read in high school or college. Fitzgerald published his first novel in 1920, This Side of Paradise, which was well received. The New York Times said at the time that Fitzgerald had a delightful literary style. He published four novels during his lifetime, along with many short stories. The Great Gatsby is said to be his best work. Hemingway published his first novel in 1926, The Sun Also Rises, which some say is his best work. The New York Times called it a truly gripping story told in a lean, hard, athletic narrative prose that puts more literary English to shame. However, it was The Old Man and the Sea that won Ernest Hemingway the Pulitzer Prize in 1953 and contributed to him also winning the Nobel Peace Prize. Overall, Hemingway published seven novels and two works of nonfiction during his lifetime.
Their professional and personal relationship still fascinates many people today, as do their relationships with their own personal demons, especially in light of the ever-changing conversations we're having about sexuality, mental illness, and toxic masculinity. The most recent major exploration of Hemingway's life comes from Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's PBS documentary, Hemingway, a three-part series that first aired on PBS April 5th. Our guest today, Amanda Vail, can be seen in the film. She is also the author of the best-selling book, Everybody Was So Young, Gerald and Sarah Murphy, A Lost Generation Love Story, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Biography, and Somewhere, The Life of Jerome Robbins, for which she was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. In addition to her screenplay for the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning public television documentary, Jerome Robbins, Something to Dance About, she has also written features and criticism for a range of journals from Allure to the Washington Post Book World. Everybody Was So Young is a fascinating, in-depth portrait of the extravagant, magnetic couple that ruled the literary scene in Paris in the 1920s, which of course included both Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and all of their messy relationships. So, Hemingway and Fitzgerald is what we're talking about today. An oldie but a goodie, I think. It's a perennial favorite, as we mentioned. And I really, you know, I'm not alone in this, but I love both of these writers and was very affected by them early, probably because we are, you know, they are always required reading in high school and college, but really just felt like, oh my God, this is what being a writer is, right? I feel like that's like when you picture author, these are the guys you think of.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Great Gatsby was personally one of my favorite required reading books in high school, partly because I had such a wonderful freshman English teacher at the time, but also because the characters were just so loud and racy and alive. As a 16-year-old, like, what is this book? Like, what are these people having all these parties? And I was also personally really into reality television back in the day. So like watching rich people in the 1920s moving about their fancy lives and making a mess out of everything was really satisfying. Personally, I didn't take as much to Hemingway. I don't know if it's because, I mean, we weren't able to really get into the nuances of him. We read, we'll cut here and then I'll pause.
I actually get his stuff confused all the time.
The
titles are so just like they're, it's all kind of him and they're all, the titles are just so ingrained in you that you can actually forget which one's which.
Exactly. It was A Farewell to Arms. I was like, it wasn't For Whom the Bell Tolls, but we didn't read The Old Man and the Sea. In my class, we read A Farewell to Arms, and it didn't do it for me, but what did do it for me was Hills Like White Elephants. That short story, just getting at the really difficult, I mean, now it's still hard to talk about, it seems, for, you know, where it's not in the mainstream conversation still. So to have it in this story appear in such a veiled, but still really visceral way, was really powerful. So I'm really excited after watching the PBS doc, reading Everybody Was So Young, to get back into Hemingway as an adult.
Yeah, the one thing I always loved about him is his writing style and how distinctive it is, which again, there's nothing we can say here in some ways that's anything new to the conversation, right? Though Amanda Bell, our guest, does, and she's very fun talking about them. Loved Gatsby, loved the very florid prose. I still think about the shirts scene, the scene where Gatsby's throwing around his shirts, and it's so beautiful, and it sticks with you. But Hemingway was such a specific kind of stylist, and I love distinctive voices and the way that you could just imitate him at any time and everyone would know what you're doing. It just really, that spoke to me very early in my sort of wanting to be a writer. And also the fact that he was kind of did both journalism and fiction and veiled, you know, fiction that was kind of just veiled nonfiction, all of those things. He kind of did them all together throughout his life. And that too was really influential for me, kind of feeling like, oh, that's something I could imagine doing. And that seemed really cool. Plus, just as we kind of get into even more with Amanda, like the fame level, I mean, we'll never have that. And I mean, by that, I mean, any living writer today will never, I don't totally. Think, totally. You know.
No, I've been thinking about that too. And like how there are just so many books in the world and so many voices, which is amazing. But also you kind of feel like, oh my God, will I ever read everyone that I really am excited to read? Whereas of course, when Hemingway and Fitzgerald were writing, no book Twitter, no bookstagrammers, totally different landscape. And I think also the last thing I'll say that I found really interesting just about Hemingway as a person was how he crafted this identity in a way that, I mean, now we'll always see that manly, that virility, that chest pounding Hemingway. And we really have to work to peel back that narrative because he really did such a good job of solidifying that in his own way. And so I'm just really excited that now today we're finally talking about things that were happening in his childhood, like things with his parents that, you know, we weren't able to get into hundreds of years ago or even 20 years ago. So
absolutely. And even kind of looking more at some of the things he really did tackle in ways that we would consider fairly modern. I mean, some ways they weren't, but you know, the way, you know, he tackled things like abortion or something like that, you know, where he was, really, he did more than just tell us stories about war and fishing. And I think he was so good at crafting his own image that it sort of consumed his legacy a little bit. But it's just reminding me of this. This is a very weird little insight that I have that's unique to my career. But I spent a brief time editing a group of home decor trade magazines in my 20s. We all do things, you know? And that happened to be the year that they announced this Hemingway line of decor. I really remember the ceiling fans, but there were a number of others. There were picture frames, there were accessories. And it was all this like, you know, wicker and wood.
I was going to ask what kind of,
like
a Hemingway pattern, like
it's like tusks and bamboo. And like, so it was kind of that Florida, that like masculine Florida aesthetic going on when he lived down there. I met the grandson or something like that at it and had my picture taken with me. It looked exactly like Ernest Hemingway. It's amazing. Wait,
this should be shared on.
I'll see if I can dig that up. It's amazing all around. But to me, the reason I bring this up, I swear, is for an actual point, which is that, can you imagine having such a large a persona as an author that decades later, someone makes a line of home decor that is like based on what they imagine your aesthetic to be and people will buy it?
It's kind of insane. And also I love that. Like, I'm like, what do people do for me now?
I was just going to say the Zakiya line coming in, in 2070, like, you know? Like, yeah. It's so crazy. And I am really obsessed with, especially, I think both of them in this case, Hemingway and Fitzgerald, but Hemingway in particular, I've always been so fascinated by the way he branded himself. I mean, he is equal to the Kardashians in self-branding, and for better or worse. And
that Kanye even, right? And like where it's also kind of eating, like you created this monster and now this monster is eating you. Like, it's so
exactly. Weird. Exactly. So see, it's not that crazy for us to be asking our guests which, you know, which social medium these people would be most likely to be using, which you can find out at the end of this episode. So stay tuned.
Yes, stay tuned. We'll get into all of this and more with Amanda Vale. Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, Amanda Vale. We are so, so excited to have you here today.
Well, I'm excited to be here and thrilled to meet you both.
Thank you. Thank you. So our first question is for people who haven't read Everybody Was So Young. Can you tell us a little about the book, who Sarah and Gerald Murphy were, and how they came to know Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald?
Well, Sarah and Gerald Murphy were, I guess I would say, well-off New Yorkers who came from slightly different backgrounds, her family much more wealthy than his. But they had left America in 1921 to go and settle in Paris because they didn't want to be in America, which they felt was a very constrained kind of a place. For one thing, they're just prohibition had just been passed, and they felt like a country that would say, no, you can't have a drink in a restaurant was not a country that they wanted to live in. So they wanted to get the hell out. But they also wanted to be in a place that had a better relationship with art and artists and culture. And in the society that they moved in New York, artists were thought of as really weird, flaky people that you would never be. And they wanted to be that. And so they went and they hung out with the people around the Ballet Russe with Picasso and Diaghilev and all of these European, Cocteau, and all of these European art creators. And also all the new American writers and artists who were coming to Paris in the 20s, which they did, including Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Man Ray and Dorothy Parker. And I mean, a really wild selection of people. And they essentially adopted many of these people. They were maybe 10 years older than a lot of this generation. They were kind of like the Gen X and Gen Y, to each other. And they were like the godparents of the lost generation. They gave them money, they gave them food, they helped them out, they critiqued their work, they introduced one person to another person. And that was what they did. And I was fascinated by them because they were like the people, if you had a family album of the 20s and you looked at it and you'd see all the famous people that you knew, and then all of a sudden you'd see these two other people in all these pictures and you'd say, who are they? Who are those people in that picture? And that would be the Murphys. And you wonder why they would be in every picture, and it's because they made the picture. They made it happen. And they allowed all of these other people to do the work that they did. They, as I say, they gave them money, they gave them a place to work, they gave them a place to stay. And that was how, therefore, they came to know these two quite different writers.
Can we get a little bit into Hemingway and Fitzgerald here? Can you give us kind of your take on their relationship? Do you see it as a rivalry, a friendship? Both, neither?
Oh, I think, you know, the thing about Hemingway is that he almost never had a friend that wasn't really a frenemy. That really, he invented the term before it was even a term. And I think part of it came from the fact that he was an intensely competitive man, just so amazingly competitive. And I don't think he could be friends with anybody that he ever felt was better at something than he was. And which was a very unfortunate thing for him, because it meant that he always had to run people down. And in the end, that cost him friends. And it cost him a feeling of having friends and having them be around him, be there for him. Fitzgerald had a way of exhausting his friends and being very demanding. He was, you know, they're both really sort of narcissistic or solipsistic in different ways. And Fitzgerald was like, he was needy. He was so needy. And he was constantly, he needed attention. He needed love. He needed to feel special. You know, you can't do that for people all the time. It's hard. So I think their friendship was bound to kind of run aground on that sort of their similarity and their unlikeness in that sense. So that's what I would say, I guess. But the fact is, they also admired each other. I would say that Fitzgerald probably admired Hemingway more than vice versa. Fitzgerald was actually the person who got Hemingway to Scribner as his publisher. He helped to arrange that, the meeting with Maxwell Perkins that really enabled Hemingway to flourish at Scribner's. He edited Hemingway's work, and in really good ways. And Hemingway was quite resistant to that often. But Fitzgerald, Hemingway didn't have the same kind of respect for Fitzgerald's work. He would say, oh, you know, this isn't as good as that other thing that you wrote, but you're a really wonderful writer, but this new thing, that's not so good. And, you know, that's kind of hard to hear. I think he was just really competitive. And I'm also not sure. I think Fitzgerald's work made him very uncomfortable in ways that I'll get into later if you want.
Yeah, I would love to hear about that. I'm getting the feeling, you know, admittedly, I am currently watching the Hemingway documentary. And something I picked up from that is that it seemed like Hemingway was really kind of into mansplaining everything.
Oh, a lot of that.
Everyone, right?
Another term he might have invented. I mean,
So in what ways did Hemingway's and Fitzgerald's personal experiences and relationships manifest themselves in their work? It seemed to be a very common thing of the time in general, and specifically for them to really be kind of cannibalizing their experiences almost right after they had them into what they called fiction a lot of the time, but really almost wasn't.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they... Didn't you ever have a teacher said, write what you know?
Yes.
And I remember when I used to be a book editor, one of the things that I used to tell writers when I went to writers' conferences was, would you please forget that? Would you just forget that? Mm-hmm. Because I would really so much rather get a manuscript about something you don't know, because it would be so much more interesting. But they didn't do that. Although I would argue that, Fitzgerald's early work, like certainly The Side of Paradise, and to a large extent, The Beautiful and Damned, is really very much draws on his own experience. And he's kind of the buried hero of all of those things. He later developed a very complex relationship to his narrative point of view. Something like Tender as the Night, which starts out being told from the point of view of Rosemary, who is an actress who in some ways, you know, is a modified version and a transgendered version, maybe in more ways than he even intended, of Fitzgerald. But the main characters in that book are really not like him. They're really Sarah and Gerald Murphy. And in fact, in early drafts of that manuscript, they are called Sarah and Gerald, which Dick and Nicole Diver are called Seth. They're called Seth and Dinah, but before they're called Seth and Dinah, they're called Gerald and Sarah, or Sarah and Gerald. Hemingway is always, he's so in his work. And it so speaks with his point of view, I want to say. I don't think he ever wrote a novel that was not from his point of view. I don't mean to say that the characters were him, or that the people in the novels or the stories were him or his wives or other people, but the point of view of the main character is really always his point of view. And in that sense, his work is a lot more autobiographical than Fitzgerald's, I think.
That's so interesting. And that kind of ties into our next question, which is, both seem to be masters of self-mythology, or even what we might call branding now. How do you think their public images interacted with their work? And what role, if any, did it play in their relationship with each other?
Well, you know, Fitzgerald was he was a famous one first, and he got famous for having written this novel, and then he got famous for being young and having this beautiful wife, and then all of them behaving like people in their novels and his novels. And I think he did become a victim of that. And one of the reasons he went to France was to get away from this persona that he created of, you know, the flapper and the arrow collar man, which is kind of what he felt like. So they went to France to get away so he could write and maybe not constantly always be surrounded by this mythos that he created. Hemingway, on the other hand, I think he claimed that he wanted to escape, but in fact he didn't, I don't think. I feel that he saw this this image, this mythology, this brand in a way. I think it was very harmful for him. And I don't think he knew how to get away from it. I feel that in a sense, he was tormented by it, but he didn't know to what extent he had helped to create this, and he didn't know how to get away from it. And I think, you know, that was his conflict. It was sort of like the old man in the sea. He had this giant fish that he's trying to deal with, and he didn't know what to do with it. He couldn't, you know, in the end, it does for him.
In a related, on a related note, can you give us a sense of how famous they were in their time? I mean, do we even have writers who get that famous now?
Well, you know, I guess, I don't know. Do we have writers that are that famous now? I mean, I don't know. Is Katniss Everdeen as famous as Annie Fitzgerald character? I don't know. Or, you know, I think maybe young adult fiction is sells in the numbers. I quite honestly can't remember the numbers, and I'm not going to be able to quote them to you, but Hemingway, you know, was on the cover of Time magazine, for God's sake. He was on the cover of Life magazine. Fitzgerald was, you know, he was enormously famous. We didn't have TikTok. We didn't have YouTube. We didn't have so many things that make celebrities out of people who haven't actually done anything. I mean, they didn't have Kardashians. What they did have is they had celebrities who were socialites and who were, you know, all over what they call the rotogravure, which is the sort of swanky part of the newspaper that was printed on good stock and had good photographs. And that section of the paper always would, newspaper, they would have these people who were celebrities also. But no, we don't have anything that's quite like that anymore, again, because other kinds of entertainment have really taken the place of writing.
Yeah. And, you know, I was really taken while watching the PBS documentary, though, still, of how much video footage there was and there is of Hemingway. Like, I really enjoyed watching him just, like, be burly around and talk and have these interviews of people. It was so fascinating. I wish I had watched more of that at a younger age. All right, so our next question. So Hemingway in particular was very concerned with issues of masculinity in his work, as we all know. And his image, as you talked about so beautifully, was built on this. How do you think masculinity played into the rivalry between Hemingway and Fitzgerald?
Oh, it played hugely into it in ways that, well, that they were not always, maybe not always conscious of. And it's a very complex thing. There's a chapter or a section in Hemingway's memoir, A Movable Feast, in which he talks about being with Scott Fitzgerald, and Fitzgerald being very nervous and anxious about the size of his penis, and how he wonders if he's adequate, and I'm not even sure this ever took place, but it is the kind of thing that Hemingway would most definitely have wanted to write about Fitzgerald later to prove that he had a bigger one, or he didn't worry about it because he was so cool that he didn't have to, which is kind of the way he wanted to act about this. What's really interesting is that, I said earlier that Sarah and Gerald Murphy were kind of a litmus test for both Fitzgerald and for Hemingway in terms of their attitudes about a lot of things, including sexuality. And one of them is this: Gerald Murphy was essentially a closeted gay man. He was somewhat closeted from himself, but only for a period. And he was happily married to and was madly in love with his wife, as some gay men feel about some women. But Hemingway was made so uncomfortable by Gerald, and he was made uncomfortable by his sexuality and by his not being out there about it, I guess. He would have been more horrified, I guess, if Gerald had been very overtly homosexual in front of him, but he would have been able to avoid him. He wasn't able to avoid him in this sense. And that, it made Hemingway so uncomfortable. He said, "I always felt about Gerald the way people who don't like cats feel about cats." And to me, that's just incredibly revealing about Hemingway. Yeah. Fitzgerald, on the other hand, had his own feelings about them. When I was talking about Tanderissa Knight, one of the things that's interesting is that in the early versions of that manuscript, the narrator, who is called Francis Mullarkey — Francis was Scott Fitzgerald's first name, actually, Francis Scott Fitzgerald — Mullarkey is an Irish word for sort of nonsense, smokescreen, something that you tell somebody. It's a lot of malarkey. You tell it to, it's to be misleading. Mm-hmm. And his name is Francis Mullarkey, and he is in love with the woman of this couple that is based on the Murphys. He couldn't write that story because, although he idolized Sarah, I think he wasn't actually in love with her, or maybe he was, but he was also sort of in love with Gerald. Mm-hmm. And so he changed the narrator to Rosemary, a girl who is in love with Dick Diver, the Gerald figure. And then the novel works for him. Mm-hmm. And so I'm feeling like, in a weird way, both Fitzgerald and Hemingway had sort of ambivalence issues. Hemingway, as we know, enjoyed cross-dressing sometimes, cutting his hair shorter than his wives, or as short as his wives, having them both dye their hair in Garden of Eden. The husband and the wife are treating each other in sort of sex role reversal. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on in Hemingway's life. And I keep thinking, you know, there's that sexual ambivalence in Fitzgerald, there's sexual ambivalence. Zelda Fitzgerald once said, "Oh, Ernest, you and Scott are just a couple of fairies." And, you know, Zelda was nuts, and everybody wrote it off to her being nuts. But the question is whether, and maybe that wasn't even true because it's Hemingway who told the story, but, but I think there's an ambivalence that runs through both of these men, and it's worth thinking about.
Yeah, that, you know, that reminds me of a quote from your book that I have here that I just feel like I should read. "When I like men, I want to be like them," Fitzgerald wrote. "I want to lose the outer qualities that give me my individuality and be like them. I don't want the man. I want to absorb into myself all the qualities that make him attractive and leave him out.
Cannibalism.
I immediately thought of The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yes.
And
yes!
I saw so much of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
You're so right,
though. That character. Yeah, it's so fascinating.
That is entirely true.
Yeah. So, thank you. All right. So our next question is about white cis male authors. So a great topic. When we were planning out which writers we would be discussing this month, we wondered a little bit about whether or not we should discuss two white male cis writers again, since last month we covered Ray Bradbury. We really want to make sure that Dead Writer Drama covers a diverse array of authors, especially ones people might not already know much about. But with the brilliant Burns and Novick PBS documentary airing, of course, earlier this month, they just felt so right. And we're, of course, so happy to be talking to you about them today. So our conversation about ensuring the authors we discuss on this podcast is part of a bigger conversation about the literary canon. For years, certain writers like Hemingway and Fitzgerald have gotten a lot of the glory, and many people have been pressing for schools to diversify their curriculums more. So I pose to you a little devil's advocate. If we had to pick either Hemingway or Fitzgerald to keep for, say, a high school reading course, which one would you fight to keep and why?
That's a really hard question. I can never choose. I'm the person who, I couldn't choose between the Beatles and the Stones. I can't choose between Billy and Ella. I can't do it. It depends on my mood at the time. And so, my feeling about Hemingway is that he's a stylist who, and not just a stylist, he has a vision for what fiction and art can, prose can do, that is so new and so clean and sharp and important. If you want to know what 20th century modernism and modernist writers are doing, you need to read him, because you can't not read him. You won't get a good sense of what was going on in fiction, in American fiction, in the 20th century, if you don't. Fitzgerald is something else in that sense. He's out of the time. I mean, he may have written, his early novels are about, you know, sort of flappers and large parties and very 1920s, roaring 20s type stuff. Very jazz age. He is the jazz age. But in fact, that's not what his fiction is really about. And his best fiction isn't about that. And his style, his prose style, really isn't about that. He is a much more 19th century or, you know, sort of classic novelist. And he's somebody that I would see out of time. And that if you don't read him, you miss some really important statements about people and who they are and what they can be. And it doesn't matter what their gender is or what their ethnicity is or what their age is. There's just, The Great Gatsby is a novel about possibility and disappointment. And we have all wanted possibilities and we have all been disappointed. And I think it's one of the most tragic novels about what America does to its people. And you know, you read that and it changes how you think about things. So I don't know how to pick. I can't pick.
I honestly,
okay, that's a better answer anyway.
Exactly. And I was going to ask you to make it, because I, when I was writing this question, I was like, oh, people are going to hate me, because this or that is really hard. But I was also going to ask you, if you were to press, I mean, we don't have to go into this necessarily, but if you were to press one book into a young person's hands first, which one that would be?
What would be the one? Well, this is another toughie, because, you know, I think whether it would be the, you know, Hemingway's selected stories would be the one if I were going to do, if I were going to, for a young person too, because I think there's a lot there for them. Quite honestly, I think The Great Gatsby is, that's a tough book.
Yeah.
I mean, it, and you kind of have to have a little maturity to deal with it. Mm-hmm. I think the thing about Hemingway too is that he's so direct and the prose goes so right to you. You immediately connect with it. And there's something about the way he goes, his descriptions of the natural world are so, so immediate, so close, so brilliantly observed. You know, that would be the thing. To me, he's the maybe one of the greatest short story writers that has ever lived. And to me, that's the greatest, his greatest fiction is his short fiction. It was a perfect medium for him.
I'm convinced. You have
me. Sold. I sold you.
We were talking a little bit about their own masculinity before. Who do you think wrote women better?
Oh, I think Fitzgerald wrote women better. Hmm. I just right away. I mean, let's not forget that Fitzgerald was in the Triangle Club. His club at Princeton had a drag show, and he was one of the, he was a girl in it. I mean, he got girls. I don't know quite why that is, because Hemingway had sisters and he was close to them, certainly when he was young, but I don't think that he entered into their imaginative lives in the same way. And I always had real trouble with his female characters. I was thought Catherine was like a projection of what, they all seem to me to be projections of what a man wants a woman to be.
Totally.
And I don't feel that about Fitzgerald's heroines. I mean, some of them are horrible, complicated bitches. I mean, really? Daisy? Oh my God.
Oh, worse.
You know, and then there's Jordan Baker, the cool girl.
Yeah.
She's a cool, mean girl, and she's so interesting.
That's great. And I mean, I guess this kind of ties in with my last question, but who do you think has had the greater cultural influence?
Again, you know, I gotta say, I think the greater cultural influence is probably Hemingway.
Yeah.
Leaving aside all of the macho Hemingway-esque, you know, hair on the chest type stuff.
Yeah.
That people attribute to him, and rightly or wrongly, just the style alone, the numbers of writers who copy him consciously or unconsciously, just his, the way that he presented writerness to people. And Fitzgerald never did. But I will tell you, there is one thing that I think Fitzgerald never gets the credit for. And I think it's really, really important. He wrote the first confessional, I think he wrote the first confessional memoirs ever in this country. And now people go to graduate school to learn how to do this.
Right.
Specifically. But The Crack Up, which is two different articles written in 1935 and published in Esquire, both of them are confessional in a way that nothing, I mean, Hemingway actually reviled them because they were way too uncomfortable and too TMI for him. He just couldn't deal with it. And it was a real overshare in Hemingway's view. And he told Fitzgerald that. But in fact, Fitzgerald couldn't see any other way to get beyond where he was than by making a clean breast of all the crap that he felt that he was carrying around. And he did this. And at the time, nobody really noticed. It didn't make a huge impression. When he died, those essays were collected by his friend Edmund Wilson and published with a whole bunch of other things, short pieces and stuff, miscellany, in a collection called The Crack Up by New Directions, not even by Scribner's, his actual real longtime publisher, because nobody cared about this stuff. But those two essays remade the way people write memoir and autobiographical nonfiction now. And I just think it's incredible.
So. That is really fascinating because that is how everyone does it now. So
that's huge.
That actually is a great segue to my next question, which is whose life would make the better biopic?
Well, it depends on whether do you want madness or do you want they both have alcoholism in them. So you got a lot of drinks. People are getting drunk all the time.
Yes.
Fitzgerald's life is a very sad life, and I don't think it would make very rewarding viewing. You'd just be really depressed afterwards. Hemingway's life has a much more satisfactory arc to it because there is great fame, there is great success, and then there is tragedy. He comes, as you've seen, if you've watched this documentary, the last chapters of Hemingway's life are as tragic as anything you'd want to see. The guy is completely bonkers. He is, you know, suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome or head trauma or whatever. He is hopped up on pills. He's zonked out of his mind and he's not able to write and he's miserable. And it's so tragic to think of this guy who used to be able to do anything and in such pain from all of this plane crashes and injuries of one kind or another, this incredibly athletic guy who was just like a movie star when he burst on the scene. Well, both he and Fitzgerald were, you know, in their different ways, very handsome as young men. I think Hemingway gets the nod there.
Okay.
Yeah, those last. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say those last 10 minutes of that PBS documentary. I was watching it earlier today and I just wanted to curl up and blanket. I was like, this is so sad to see.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking. Yeah. And to someone who had his confidence and his swagger and his sureness about what he wanted to do. And then to not have that, I just think I can't imagine what that must have cost him every day to feel that confusion.
Yeah, so devastating. Well, we are going to move on to a little bit of a more brighter note with our lightning round questions. So our first lightning round question is, which work of theirs, if any, would each author pick to be dramatized on screen today?
Well, I think Hemingway would probably pick the movie, the book that became, I think, probably the most successful movie, in fact, which is For Whom the Bell Tolls. It has action, it has love, it has politics, it has everything that he liked. And it makes a really pretty damn good movie. I think if Fitzgerald could pick one, I think he would pick the novel he didn't finish, which is the Hollywood novel, Last Tycoon, because it's got Hollywood and it would make such a fabulous movie, except it's never been successfully done.
That would be good. I mean, there's so many Gatsbys, so we don't need any more of those, but that would be really cool. All right, next one. Paperback, hardcover, or audiobook, which would be their preferred method of reading?
The idea of either of them with an audiobook is so disorienting. I can't even imagine because, you know, they'd have to have like a device.
Earbuds.
Oh, no, I cannot. You know, I just think earbuds are not going to work for either of them. So I'm going to say Hemingway paperback and Fitzgerald hardcover. Hemingway wants the paperback because he can put it in his pocket and go out fishing.
That's right.
Go on adventures.
Yeah.
Which, if any, form of social media would they use? Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok?
Oh, most definitely Hemingway would go for Twitter. It's short. Mm-hmm. And Fitzgerald would go for Facebook because you'd have long confessional posts and say everything that's on your mind. Yeah.
I love that. No TikTok for either of them.
Yeah. Way too performative.
No dancing.
I thought actually that one of them would do Instagram for some reason. I guess I was thinking.
I think it's possible that actually either of them mm-hmm. would. And possibly, weirdly, I think Hemingway might have been the Instagram guy, because not so much that he took a lot of photographs, because he didn't, but he had such a love for the natural world, and it mm-hmm. might have been something that he would have thought, oh, well, I'll take this little gadget camera in my phone that I can suddenly magically carry with me and take pictures of these trout.
Yeah. I love that idea so much. I can't even stand it. Just seeing like Hemingway being like out fishing again, you know?
Yes. And like scrolling through the filters, like,
right. That's right. Yep. How can I make my fish look bigger?
Here's me at the bullfight. Yeah. Oh, it was a good kill. Click. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And our last one, who would be better or worse to quarantine with?
Well, it depends on whether there would be any booze in the house, because this could be a lot of, this could create problems in every possible way.
For sure.
I think Hemingway would be the worst, because actually, if there was booze, he would get drunk and argumentative. Mm-hmm. And if there wasn't, he would get twitchy and restless and want to go out and do things. And mm-hmm. you keep having to say, no, you can't. You have to wear a mask. I have to what? You know, so that would be that. And I think Fitzgerald would be horrible, because basically he would either be blotto or he'd be morose and sad mm-hmm. all the time.
Dramatic.
Yeah. Although he might be quite charming, because I do, you know, when he, towards the end of his life, when he was hanging out with Sheila Graham in Hollywood, and his heart was bad and he was having to be careful of himself, he was apparently quite sweet and, you know, mm-hmm. like to hang out and just read books and talk. So, you know, that might, he might be kind of pleasant, but just really lock up the liquor. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, honey, you would just have a sad drunk. I mean, Fitzgerald was the kind of guy that would get completely crazy. He'd be so hammered, and then he would fall on his knees and clutch you around the knees and say, don't leave me, stuff like that. So you just don't want that.
No, definitely not. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This was really fun.
Well, that was really fun. Thank you. It was great. And I enjoyed it so much. You both were fabulous questioners and great readers. And this has been a real pleasure.
Thank you
so much.